pals o' mine. So here's a fun birthday get-together idea. We did this last night for my brother's birthday. We met at a dive bar because they usually don't serve food and so don't mind if you bring your own. Because it was Monday night football, they have a few big screen TVs, they were serving hot dogs. But for our table, we brought salami, cheese, crackers, Swedish meatballs, and cupcakes. It was also happy hour, so yay for us. Fern Jones has experienced quite a few adventures, I'm sure including a few dive bars himself. Frogman during World War II, Roughneck, Dude Ranch, Hobo, and Artist over his 88 years.
So tell me where you grew up.
Grew up in Blue Ridge Mountains in northern Georgia. Back then there was just little farms and whatever. Mountain folks, there was a place called Bird Mountain. It was high country, no roads. My grandfather Jones was a farmer, but he also was a contract mail carrier. And once a month, he hitched the old horse to the buggy and he went up in them hills. No roads, he just broke trail. And took these people their mail once a month. And I went with him a couple of times. And he talked about, the people were originally, like all of us, our ancestors, it was Welsh, Irish, British. And these people still had that accent. And I wondered, I asked my grandpa, where do these people come from, Pop? He said, they're just Americans like us. But I had a hard time believing that because they had still had a Welsh, English, sound less like people in Britain. Well, they'd never been in America except right there where they settled when they came over on the boat. And I always thought that was the strangest thing. The way the kids, I couldn't understand them. They had a real English dialect and it just blew me away. I said, these people are nuts. Well, they didn't have a school.
Did you try to imitate their accents? Talk like them?
Yeah, we used to kid one of them. My ancestors were Welsh. Jones is Welsh, strictly. One old guy, I saw him on TV one time. He was real famous in America. He had a big following. He sang. Tom Jones. I often wondered if he's kin to me, but he said one time on TV that says, you can go in any town, any village in Wales, and go out on the street and holler, hey, Jones! And about half the people will say, yeah.
Good place to get lost.
Yeah.
Do you know the reason your family came over here?
When they sent a lot of them to Australia, quite a few of them got to America. You recall what I'm talking about?
In the penal colonies?
Yeah. The English shipped a whole bunch of people. That's how Australia became the country it is. They're all people that the Crown sent them there. And there was quite a few got scattered. But Wales, one of my great-grandmas was from Ireland. And my great-grandpa was a Welshman, and if you look at the map, directly across the Irish Sea is that town where my grandma grew up. He goes fishing, puts into Ireland port, and they met her, and that's how they got to be married and come back to Wales, and then eventually wound up in North Georgia in America. And they never went anywhere else in America. They came over on the ship, and people scattered all throughout. That's how most of the Irish and English and Welsh people in America, their ancestors landed on the North Carolina and Georgia and Virginia, and some of the first colonies, first people. My grandfather Hamilton, my mother's dad, he was Scottish, Hamilton. But a lot of those old people still had accents. When I was growing up, I couldn't understand it.
My great-grandfather, Swedish. I didn't understand half of what he was saying either.
He still got an accent.
Very thick.
It's hard to lose an accent if you've had it a long time.
Well, I met an Irishman on a hike, and his brogue was still thick, even though he'd been in this country for like 30 years. And I asked him, how come you still have an accent? And he said, I saw no reason to lose it. Good enough. So how many kids are in your family?
Five boys.
Oh, boys.
Yeah.
Oh, poor mom.
Poor mom. Yeah, my mom, she was a great.
Where were you in the lineup, age-wise?
Second from the oldest.
Okay.
And one older than me. And the one older than me is gone. The one just below me is gone. There's three of us left. My brother, he would flew all his life. He was a crackerjack pilot. And I know he was stubborn enough that he had some ailment that he never told anybody about. Probably a cramp here and there. But he had colon cancer. That's what killed him. And he was he flew for Coca-Cola, the private pilot, 32 years. He could fly a plane, he'd land a plane, and you couldn't feel it. You'd just be waiting. You know, most airplanes, commercial, private, you feel that touchdown when it skid that tire, and you feel that little. He could land a plane. You shut your eyes, and the first thing you know, you're there, and you never feel it. He was that good.
What was his name?
Milton. We call him Hotch.
Because?
Hotch. He was a hell of a sportsman. Football player. He could run the football just so fast, they call him Hotch Hopscotch.
Oh.
And Hotch, he was a great football player when he was going to school.
What about you?
Yeah, I played a little football. I played a little everything. And I like golf. I used to do some magic things with them. I just had a knack for it, I guess. Somebody sold me on one of them putting courses, and I kept hitting a ball right into the bucket, and the guy said, "Hey, you make a good golfer." This sure got me interested in regular golf.
What was school like for you? Did you like it, or was it just something you had to do?
Well, I loved it the first few years. I was an A student. I made A's, all of them, you know, first, second, third grade, and boy. And one time I got a B, and boy, I was really shook up. And my mother said, "Hey, that's good." I thought, you know, the world had come to an end. I got a B.
Do you remember what subject it was?
Math.
Ah, me too.
And then after that, you know, I didn't care much about math after that.
It turned on you.
Turned on me.
So what happened after third grade?
Oh, I done pretty good. I didn't excel in anything. I just kind of rode on through.
So who was your best friends? What did you guys do for fun?
When I was growing up?
Yeah.
Oh, I had good buddies that we went everywhere together in the summer especially. Roaming through the mountains, digging tunnels, and we had a cave.
Nice.
We'd live in that cave.
How long?
Well, there's a bear had been in it. She was smelling, but my grandpa said, "If he ever comes back, you boys are in trouble."
Just FYI.
But we built us a bed in there, and a lot of weekends we'd there's a river right below we'd fish. Where I grew up, there's a stream, and there's more streams in North Georgia than any state.
I didn't know that.
Little, what do we call them, branches. Creeks. Right where we lived, there was a stream coming up out of the ground, right by the garden. We had a vegetable garden that wouldn't quit because it was watered year-round. Springs everywhere. Georgia was full of them. They just bubbled up out of the ground. They run 2 or 3 miles and back into the ground. So you can find a cool drink just every 30, 40 feet. I'll never forget it. Just many, many streams.
So you had a lot of fresh produce for your meals.
Oh, yeah.
Feed the family, I'm
go
sure.
Through the garden on our way to the fishing hole and pull a big ripe tomato or a cucumber. Always had a salt shaker in her pocket.
Oh. So what kind of fish did you catch in the fishing hole?
Trout, bream, catfish, all kinds. There were all kinds of trout.
Did you cook them right there on the spot? Did you?
Sometimes, yeah. Just build a little fire out of stick branches from the trees, and oh, we knew how to. We lived, you know, wilderness style. Us kids. That's why I was so handy as a Navy SEAL. I lived in the jungles and in the islands down there. Man, I was at home.
It was your natural habitat.
Yeah, living like an animal. Scared the hell out of the Japanese army. They got wind of it. You know, we were secret outfit during the war. We weren't advertised. It's and there aren't SEALs back then.
So what years were you a SEAL?
44, 45.
So the beginning of the war then, or the towards the end, I mean?
Well, the last half of the World War II. It was really getting hot by then. But we had already taken a lot of them big islands. The Japanese, if they'd had any brains, they could have seen the end was coming because we were wiping them out all over there. It got, what was so bad, you know, is the suicide people. Right at the end, they just dedicated themselves. I don't know how you find that thousands of men stand up and say, I'll go kill myself.
Sacrifice myself for my country.
And for what? The end, you know, anybody could see the end was coming near. It was just a matter of time. At Okinawa. Yes, all of them got them plans and just, well, they caused a lot of damage. They hit those big carriers right in the top, set fire, caused a lot of havoc. But in the long run, they still went down.
What were your duties as a SEAL during that time?
Swimming around in the jungle, blowing things up.
Planting devices?
Planting ships or whatever, you know, they blew up one of their maintenance yards where they had a couple of three mobile units. Anything that put them out of action. We didn't fool around with single people, but we did shoot them at night, and that's what got them so confused. They heard rumors that one Japanese that spoke great English. In fact, he grew up in California. He one day, this was long after the war, and I'd been blowing up mines up and down the coast. He said, Jones, there was rumors that there were some of your people were actually half crocodile, that American had experimented with men's genes and transplanted them to a crocodile.
Wow.
And they got this thing that could, he would still look pretty much like a crocodile, but he could understand English.
Sounds like a comic book.
And I said, are you kidding me? No, he said, that's what the rumor was in Japan, especially on Okinawa. Because we've been doing some stuff to them, and they didn't know where it was coming from. They said, there ain't no planes come over. Well, we can see the ships out there lobbing big shells, but nobody's been ashore, and how's all this stuff happening? So this creature that's half alligator and half man is sneaking up. And if they seen us, somebody seen us at one time, and we did wore them rubber suits, and their feet, you know, were the big flippers, the fins, for swimming,
mm-hmm.
And we had black rubber gloves, and our faces were blacked, and the hood of the rubber suit, you know, fit everything but the face. So if you seen a guy come out of the water, if you didn't know exactly what you're looking at, you thought it was some kind of varmint.
Creature of the Black Lagoon.
Yeah, so we had a lot of them people pretty well scared up, you know. They passed a lot of, you know, when somebody sees something, they don't know what it is.
Their imagination can get the best of
it. By the time it gets to the third or fourth guy, it is, boy, it's something really outrageous. And that's what happened, I'm pretty sure.
So how did your natural talents kick in to help yourself in your
being team? Able to swim in the water for a long time.
So how long were you able to hold your breath?
3 minutes back then.
Wow.
That's hard.
Yes, it is.
I couldn't do it today, I guarantee. I don't know, I might. But you had to be a excellent swimmer. The younger, like me and a couple more boys, was a young mountain varmints. We had a lot of skills that you wouldn't learn in town. Survival skills. And in fact, they were expert shots with pistol, rifle, whatever. Target range, we just wiped them out. So they naturally picked us. We thought we were something special, you know.
The elite.
And my guy, my buddy, finally, Ozzy said, "Jimmy, you know what we are? We're Suicide Squadron." And I said, "By God, yeah, I'm beginning to believe it." But now I never thought much about it.
You were able to keep in touch with any of your fellow SEALs after the war?
Two. I went to visit them in their home state after the war. We were close. We were closest family there. You had to be. You trust your buddy with your life in a lot of cases. We weren't SEALs back then. That's something very new to me. I didn't know there was reorganized. And I don't know when, but it was after the war. When the war ended, we were frogmen. We didn't have nothing to do with SEALs. That's something that somebody invented long after. I don't know when.
Sounded more glamorous, I guess.
Yeah, we were frogmen. That's just what we used to signal one another. Bullfrogs. And the Japs hear that, and they go, "What the hell?" And I heard this guy, I didn't know what they were saying, but this guy told me, he says, they heard that, these two Japanese guys, two soldiers, they heard that. We was sending signals to one another, and one of them says, "What is that?" The other says, "That's a frog." He said, "But there is no frog in these islands." and then, boy, he said, that other Jap really got shook up then. "But you sound like a frog." He said, "But there's no frogs out here." I never thought about it. I didn't know there was any frogs out there. There's a lot of things there's not any of out there. And a lot of things that you wouldn't think of finding out here somewhere.
And did you sign up during the war, or were you drafted?
No, I signed up.
You did specifically go for the Navy?
Yep, because my favorite uncle was chief petty officer on the battleship Mississippi. And you know, at Okinawa, I just got blown up a little concrete. You know, they make ships out of concrete. The Japanese had quite a few of them. I didn't know that. So I blew it up, and it cracked right in the middle. And the two ends were sticking up. And my buddy said, "Georgie, am I seeing things?" I said, "Look at that." He said, "That's concrete." And I said, and it hardly any rebar, you know, reinforcement rods. Hardly any of that, because they didn't have no more metal.
Hmm.
And after 1943, they'd use all that scrap metal that they'd bought from America in the tanks, ships, guns, and there was no metal left to make anything. So they're making ships out of concrete. And they work.
Do what they're supposed to.
But one good torpedo or a bullet, and whoom. And the charge I put under it wasn't all that big. I figured I'd just blow a hole in the side of it and it would sink. But it just fell apart like that.
Tell me about learning about explosives. What was that experience like?
Well, I have to go to school to learn about them. There's a lot of stuff to know about it. You know, there's a lot of things in the average home kitchen that you can make explosives out of. There's a lot of things that create explosives.
It must have been very specific, though, if you're in the jungles and something you can carry with you, I would imagine.
Most of all that stuff was voluntary. We volunteered for that. And once you're in the part of it, well, they send you to a school. And, well, I was just up my alley, I guess. It was that kind of a thing. You know, I was a Tom Sawyer type when I was a kid. Always building weaponry and I could make things do in a situation, and that kind of talent comes in handy. Kept me alive, I'm pretty sure.
I'm pretty sure it did too.
Knowing how to do certain things and when to do them, when to keep your head down and keep your mouth shut, a lot of that.
Timing, very important.
Yeah.
Where did you go for training? Where was your boot camp located?
Up on the Chesapeake Bay. Chesapeake. Big, big, big waterway up there. One of the biggest in the United States, the Chesapeake Bay. That's where the Naval Academy is down on one end of it. And Bainbridge is a naval training station where I first went.
Now, how old were you when you signed up?
16. I just turned 16.
Still in school, okay.
I turned 16 on January 21st, and 2 weeks later, I joined the Navy.
Boom.
Oh, I loved it, heck. I was meant for something like that, I'm pretty sure. My dad signed my papers. He said, that's right up your alley.
Did you have anybody else? You mentioned an uncle. Was there anybody else in the family that had been in the military?
My favorite uncle was Chief Petty Officer. He'd been in the Navy all his life. He was on the Mississippi, the battleship, and I was right off the end of it down there at Okinawa. I kept thinking, how am I going to get up on that big ship? And I saw something there that I told people about it, hard to believe. I shot a Japanese. They were suicide. They weren't trying to do anything, just crash their ships and their planes into a ship. The whole squadron of them. And that was happening all around. This one headed right down. He was real low. And I shot him. And finally, I know the pilot was dead, but he hit the side of the Mississippi right at the waterline. Just boop, and down he went. 30 minutes later, my buddy said, "Jonesy, will you see what I see? There's two guys in undressed blues, and their white caps, lowered a stage, which is a big plank with ropes on the end, and got down in there and was wire brushing and painting where that plane hit. It left a big splotch on the side. But right where he hit, there's 18 inches of armor on a battleship, right the waterline. A torpedo can hit, usually that's where a torpedo hits the waterline. If it hits that, it bounces off or explodes and doesn't no good. But them guys are over there painting it, and the war's going on. And my buddy says, "I don't believe this." He said, "God, if I only had a camera." It's hard to believe. People, if bombs are going off, people are shooting at it.
A little touch-up.
The boy is down there touching up that where that plane hit.
So the war ended. What did you do next?
Went into Japan and blew up all the mines all around the coast. Well, just get rid of them. Yeah. Some of them were duds, you know. They'd been around there most of the war. But there was 2,000-pounders. Boy, you could sink a good-sized ship if you hit one of them. So what we'd do, we'd go out in our boat. We had 20-millimeter machine gun, and we'd fire a shot into them. And the ones that are still good would blow up. And then but there's a minesweeper that he tows a long thing called a paravan. And when it goes through a mine cut cable, it'll cut it. No matter how hard it is, it cuts it. And then the mine comes to the surface, and then we go shoot it and blow it up or whatever. And we'd done that for about 3 or 4 months. And finally they said, the Navy sent in more boats and more people and said, "Now you guys can finally go home." I just about completed the whole coast of Honshu, which was a big island. So we loaded up, went back to Saipan, and then back to Pearl Harbor, a rest camp. Went to rest camp where you could eat whenever you wanted to, eat if you wanted to, or didn't have to get up. Rest camp, Camp Andrews, right outside of Pearl Harbor. I couldn't believe that. "What do you want for breakfast there?" "Ham and eggs." "Okay, how you like the eggs?" I said, "I never heard that in a long time." Usually, take it or leave it.
Whatever hit the fan.
Take it or leave it. It was a great day to find out that dang war was over. I really didn't expect it to ever live through it. I figured, because we were at Okinawa, you know, that's a couple hundred miles from the homeland. And I figured that'd be our last next go-around. But Uncle Harry told me he dropped them two A-bombs and that ended it.
Now, where were you when the war officially ended?
Okinawa. We had just about wound it up there, just ended it. The main part of the shootings had stopped. Yeah, it was hard to believe. Because there used to be a joke. Some guy would say, "Hey, the war's over." Yeah, it's all over the world. But this kid comes sliding down the ladder and said, "Georgie, it's over. It's over." I thought he was pulling a joke on us. And his eyes were big as that cup. And I knew something wrong with him. He said, "No kidding, it's over. The war, the Japs just surrendered." And believe it or not, people out, a lot of them ships started firing big inch guns up into the air, straight up.
Uh-oh, has to land somewhere.
That, within a 24-hour period, when they got it all calmed down, people realized what they were doing. I think there were six people got killed by falling shells. And a lot of damage to vessels and whatever. People all over the island, you know, them shells are ricocheting all over the air. Somebody realized what's happening and stopped it, but that's a shame to be killed by a falling shell after...
Survive the war only to be...
Be killed by falling ammo. The hell were we to die?
So after your rest camp, did you head back home to see your family, or did you...
Yeah, got back to Sausalito. We anchored our boat right off Sausalito. As soon as they went all over our ship and poured out our Japanese beer. You know, when I was in Japan, one day... this little old Jap had got to be my buddy, and he telling me where things was, giving me directions. I thought he was about half nuts, but he kept talking about a biru. He took me to this warehouse, me and my buddy Ozzy, and just a big old ramshackle building, and he kept saying, "Biru, biru." And I said, "Let's see what's in there." And we went inside the door, slid open the door, and there's a big lock hanging there, but that big. And there's some old run-down guy in there, and he acted like he didn't know what to do. And I looked around, there was beer, Japanese beer, stacked all over, coming big plastic crates with straw around all the bottles. And it'd be eight bottles in a case, bigger than air bottles of beer. But you know what? It turned out to be the best beer in the world. Best beer I ever drank. I asked this guy. He didn't want to talk to us. So we went back to the ship, and I asked the chief, I says, "If we still got that case of cigarettes, or Raleigh cigarettes?" "Oh yeah," I said, "nobody smokes them, nobody wants them. General Motors gave us it's a case, there's 200 cartons of cigarettes in it, 200 cartons. And I loaded that up on this Japanese motorcycle, and we went back over to the warehouse. And I got that guy out there again, I says, "Cigaretto." And his eyes got that big. And he wanted me to open it. So I opened the top, and I took out a carton. And I wrote down how many cigarettes was in this one carton, 20 packs. Oh, he couldn't believe the figures. And I said, "Now, there's 200 of these in that big case." And he got to figuring all that out. And he didn't know that was that many cigarettes in the world. You know, that's one thing in Japan. Somewhere in the middle of World War II, they had no tobacco. They had no way of getting in it. And everybody that smoked was rolling up straw. I seen this one guy, he had something, it looked like a carpet, pieces of a carpet, and he was smoking it. Oh God, I'm telling you, smell it 3 blocks. Well, they were people that smoked, and they were just as many smokers over there as anywhere. This guy, he couldn't believe his eyes. And I says, and I wasn't gonna bargain for the whole warehouse. I just want a few cases of that beer and he could have these, because nobody wanted them. Raleigh cigarettes. all the guys wanted was camels and Chesterfields. So the Raleighs was nothing to us. And this, I said, you're going to have all them cigarettes for a few cases of beer. And he handed me the key and got on his motorcycle. And his eyes, he looked like Santa Claus had just brought him his first present. And he jumped on that old motorcycle and he was gone. That case of cigarettes. And we never saw him after that. So I said, boy, we got a whole warehouse full of beer. Might as well start bootlegging it. So we got this old Jap, got a Mack truck made in London, England in 1932. That was the transportation. And believe it or not, this is wintertime. He had to build a little fire and heat the carburetor before it would, was full. It was too cold. And I thought, nobody would believe what I'm looking at here. And they finally got it and got the engine cranked. And then we were ready. Vroom, the noisy thing. And we got him down to that warehouse and loaded that beer up. I think we got, we had the truck completely full. And we pulled up to the dock and that little old boat we were on. And I called Mr. Kilcullen, the executive officer, and I said, look what I got. He said, Jones, is that what I think it is? And I said, it's old beer. He said, by God, we made a chain. And went right down into the storage locker. And they were throwing away canned goods and moving them out. Just get that beer in it. And we got that whole compartment full of beer. Finally, we got all we could handle. He said, we could drink beer for 30 years, boys. Give up. I said, and I started selling it to the troops. Soldiers, we run across them soldiers. I said, you got any beer? No. We got plenty of it. $10 a case. And we sold quite a bit of it. But when we pulled in a Sausalita, about a year later, right off the beach, Sausalita, and the Navy inspectors come, inspect for food that had any kind of food you couldn't bring in. They poured out what was left of that beer, but there's quite a bit of it. But we really had parties. What we'd do, whoever's had the watch, 8-hour watch, they would stand guard and keep anybody away, and the other guys would go down the hole and drink beer. Have a regular beer bash. And then the next night, we'd switch, and that bunch would come down. And we'd done that often, though. God. Everybody stayed about half tanked up. But the war was over, and they wouldn't have nothing to do. It's a wonder we didn't kill ourselves with messing with them mines out there, all hungover.
Oops.
But you didn't see anything like that in the war. But we had poured out quite a bit right down here in Sausalita Bay, around the San Francisco Bay.
Some happy fish.
Yeah, I kept thinking, I told the, there's a bar right across from where we was anchored, Herb Tott's Bar in Sausalita. And we went in there one time, and I told the guy, I said, we poured out enough beer to float this bar. And he said, well, why didn't you bring it over here? And I said, we couldn't get off the ship till we got rid of it. The naval inspectors, port authorities, they poured it out in the bay. I said, them fish out there, if you catch fish out there, they're about half looped. they swim up on the beach probably. We had a lot of fun there. Herb Tott's Bar in Sausalita. We stayed hangered there. We stayed tied up there for a couple of weeks. And then we went up the coast, decommissioned their boat. We picked that boat up at Portland, Oregon, and we brought it back to Astoria, which is a little fishing village up the coast. We had a ship's party there. Whatever money we had in our ship's treasure, for a canteen, we had a ship's party. Wasn't many of us left, really. Half a dozen, so six or eight guys. And then everybody got their discharges and went back to their naval station and get separated. And I only saw three of them guys after the war. I went to their homes. One guy lived in a little old town in Kentucky. And he was one of them that wanted to start a liquor business over there when he got all that beer. He wanted to open up a bar or something. Simpson. I found him in a little old town in Kentucky. Sure enough, he's bootlegging whiskey.
Good for him.
He didn't never give it up, I guess. And the cook, Cookie, he lived down in Miami, Florida. I went down there and visited him once. But most of the guys went too far away. One of my buddies lived in Detroit. And I'm eventually, about 2 years later, I went up and, well, he got married and went to Miami on his honeymoon. And my buddy in Miami told me, so I went and found him. Them three guys, about all I see.
So what direction did your life take? Where did you go from there?
Oh, oil field. I was roughnecking in the oil field. Cowboy on the ranches. Geez, so many. Shrimp fishing off the coast. Hell, I done a little everything. I loved working dew drenches.
Yeah? What was it about that was appealing to you?
Well, the open air, I love horses all my life. I grew up with horses. My grandparents had a big farm. When I was a little kid like this, I'd go jump on any, I'd jump on them big mules, and they're not supposed to be ridden, they're work mules. And every once in a while, they'd dump me off, and I'd go get on another. My grandma was always saying, that boy, you're going to wind up dead, you're going to wind up dead. Can we stay off of them mules? I was into everything like that. I was an adventurer.
So tell me about the oil field experience.
Oh, yeah. I worked in the oil field. I worked up in the dirt. Had one of them catch fire.
That's scary.
And I got out of that just in time. We was drilling in with gas. You know, there was gas. The drilling in the natural gas well. We're about 6,000 foot. And they just run a 3-inch pipeline from that well over there, over here, and drill the gas. And that's dangerous as hell. But you get the pressure, like 3,000 pounds pressure out of that well, along with your drilling mud and your bit, and that pressure of that, man, you can drill a well pretty fast, about twice as fast. Well, that well over there, you know, it took 3 months to drill. This one with the thousands of pounds of pressure, drill it in about 8 weeks. So they was going for that all over the oil field. I knew one where there was a pipeline that was a mile and a half between two rigs just to get that gas pressure. And it's dangerous. When you get to the rig, the one first thing you do, everybody that smokes, take your cigarette, put it on the dashboard. Take your matches, your cigarette lighter, make sure. Well, this one time, we had a new guy in there, one of the floor hands. He had a cigarette butt. He put his cigarettes up on there, but he had one sticking behind his ear.
Forgot about that one.
Huh?
Guess he forgot about that one.
He did, and nobody had noticed it. And he also had a pack of book matches down in the watch pocket. He forgot about that. Well, when he took the pack of cigarettes out, nobody thought the driller stopped circulating, and went into the doghouse to catch up the log. So I'm hanging up there. I'm standing on the board with my safety rope. I saw this kid on the floor. That's the way down there. I saw him reach like this. Now I'm here up here. I saw him reach and do something. I thought he was just scratching his lip because of his cigarette button. He stuck that in and I'm watching him. I thought he acts like he thinks he's gonna smoke. And he reached in his watch pocket and got out a book of matches. It hurt me to see exactly. And I saw him do this, and I said, oh, God. I reached down, unbuckled my safety belt. I jumped up, and it's just a pair of handlebars like this and a big old pulley wheel on top of a cable. And that cable was about a half a mile out there tied to a big old boulder. And I made a leap, and just as I left, I felt the heat go up my back. Boy, that whole rig just like a cannon. And hell, I was way out there. I could hear them screaming and hollering. Well, the driller, he was in the doghouse. He went down a ladder and went down there and finally got it shut off, shut the main valve off, and stopped blowing. But it had melted the A-frame. The whole rig sits on the A-frame. And the legs got too hot with that fire blowing on. The derrick done like this, real slow. It laid over and just hardly didn't hurt anything. Didn't touch the motor. Touched a big bank out by the mud pits. And this come to rest. And he got the stuff shut off. And I'm way out there. I dropped off that thing when I saw that boulder it was tied to. I dropped out 20, 30 feet out there. Man, I thought it broke something. But finally I got up and he could shut the fire off, but the rig would just kill like that. So we all had to get it up and go home. But it didn't take them long to get that rig fixed back up and drilling again. That's the worst one. That was the most damaged, dangerous job I ever had. But I worked on a lot of rigs out there in New Mexico and Arizona, out in the Indian country. Them Indians used to gather and watch us. They got a little money out of that, all them Indians, finally, you know. They were put off on reservations, treated like dirt. But after all that oil was on their land, and there was a lot of wells drilled all over Arizona and New Mexico, Utah. I finally wound up in Utah. We was drilling a escape hole this big down into a uranium mine. It was 1,200 feet down below the surface. We drilled a hole that big with a guy dreamer. And I spent all summer on that job. And we finally broke through. You could hear them guys down in there. These guys down there working. And out of that one shaft, they got $6 million worth of uranium. That's another in Moab, Utah. But I just wondered anything like that. You know, that kind of, if you got that kind of trade, you can get a job anywhere. You go to any oil field, any oil rig, you can hire out to 40 different guys on one day. And then one reason I like it, you didn't go stand in line and fill out no papers. If you had the guts, you got a job, mister. I've seen guys go into bars and restaurants. Hey, I'm looking for roughnecks. I need three good men. And finally, he'd find him two or three guys, and away they'd go. You never be out of work if you really wanted to work. Anything's dangerous. Most people won't go near it, but that was my thing. If it's dangerous, then I can handle it.
Then I got to do it.
Yeah, well, I didn't have to argue with anybody. And the money was always good.
I was going
to
say, I bet it paid well.
Paid very good.
Did you have a car or did you go?
Motorcycle.
Oh, okay.
I could go cross country, jumping over fences and through, go across rivers. If it wouldn't drown me, I would get there. Finally, you know, I worked on a pipeline, and we was going cross country to California. 3,000-mile pipeline. It's one of the biggest in the country. I could crawl into the pipe and crawl right through it. Every day, you got a little further away from home, further away from where you were hired out. And after a while, 30, 40 miles away, and then and you got paid going to work. I don't care if it took 6 hours to get to the job, you got paid. And then you got paid 8 hours on the job. But when the whistle blew, you're on your own. So I said, hell, I can't, I got to fix this. So I went and bought me a motorcycle. And when the whistle blew, one time we was 80 miles from where we started. Everybody had to drive back to Farmington, New Mexico, 80 miles. We was way out across Utah. And I said, oh, by God, I'll get there quicker. And I just cut all across country. Went through over fences, never broke anything. But one time, they had these cattle guards, and there was a little hill right up in front of this one cattle guard. And I went and I gunned it I was doing 80 miles an hour when I hit that hill and I sailed over that thing and just cleared that fence by 10 feet. And there was an old farmer sitting over there watching me. And he took off his hat and they said, God, you see me waving him. And I cut off 60 miles. Shit, I was home 3 hours before the rest of them got down. Yeah, I just cut my own trail.
So what kind of bike did you have?
Harley 45. And finally, I left the job in Aztec, New Mexico, on a Harley. And I got in between Aztec and Albuquerque. There ain't nothing but a little Indian settlement. And it come up a hell of a rainstorm. I mean, a frog strangler, we call it. And here I am, I got in the windshield. And I had on a big 10-gallon hat. And when I got to Albuquerque, I'm telling you, it looked like he drugged me through a sewer. My hat was all hanging down there. And I said, boy, I'm getting rid of this thing. I sold it to my brother-in-law. No more motorcycles.
That was it. Next?
That was the awfulest thing I heard, riding through that rainstorm. And I thought I was going blind. The rain hit me in the face. And once I pulled over to the edge, and it was even worse, you know, the wind and the whipping me around. I said, at least I'm moving. Yeah, that was the end of my motorcycle days.
How about trains? Did you ever hit the train circuit?
Yep. I used to hobo, me and old boy hoboed all the way across the country one day.
Really?
We was in New Orleans, and he said, I'm going to go, we're going to California. I said, well, we went down the river to the river bridge. It crosses upstream of New Orleans, the Mississippi River Bridge, Avondale, across the river. We climbed up the lay of that derricks. I mean, that bridge, you know, it's got the long, it's 60 feet up to the roadway. And we climbed up from the river bottom. We climbed that thing with our bags. I took our belt and tied her bags around her back. He had his around his neck. And we climbed up that lattice work on that steel, and there was a train going over it at the same time. And I said, hurry up, Hal, we're going to miss it. That's the train going to California. And we got up on the bridge, and we started running to get onto the boxcar, and the guy on the caboose hollered, no, get over there. And I thought, oh, God, we run a little faster. Train was just barely moving over that overway. We run on up, and we found an empty boxcar, and we jumped through a bag and got up in there, and we rode across the river. And that guy was after us, so we had to get off. One was in a little Negro saloon. Put a nickel in the jukebox and listen to some of that boogie-woogie music.
Nice.
Drinking beer with them black folks. And we got telling tales and all. And they just thought we was one of them, man. We were there. Yeah, we was having a lot of fun.
Beer and music, that unifies everybody, I think.
Yeah. We had fun wherever we go or whatever we done. Going across country. One time we was going to work in oil down in South America, but that blew over. Was all looking for adventures. My aunt told me, said, you guys ought to write a book about all that crap you've been through all your life. It was just like Tom Sawyer, a bunch of hobos. We hoboed freight train. Got any mischief every now and then. Well, we was hoboing. Let's see, this was some Texas, El Paso, Texas. We was at a certain place and at the wrong time, and the sheriff wouldn't know who we were, where we were going. Well, we were just a couple of vagabonds, so he took us down and locked us up in the jailhouse. Well, I said, might as well take it easy. He said, we haven't done nothing. Hal said, well, you get out. They'll let us out sooner or later. Well, next morning, the jailer said, hey, you boys, where are you headed? I said, we're headed west. Okay, get out of here. Vagrants. He picked us up for vagrancy.
Well, it's kind of funny because vagrants are always looking for some shelter, and here they gave it to you.
Yeah.
That's the irony of it.
Yeah. We didn't care. We had a good place to sleep for the night.
My great-grandmother in the early 20s was in Sacramento, and she had a reputation with all the hobos in the area because she would give them something to eat if they would just do a few errands around the house, and word just came down the line, you go see Mrs. Waybright and you'll get
back
something.
During the Depression, you saw that everywhere. That's when the boxcars were loaded with people. And I saw even families back when I was a little kid. And most any family would give a hobo something to eat. I know my mom did several times. And they would go out and beat the carpets on the rug or chop wood or anything for a little handout of meal. My mom used to fix them a dinner and put it out on the back porch. A lot of times when I was a little kid, I saw hobo stuff. During the 30s, 60-70% of America was out of work. It was bad. And we always had plenty because we had a big garden.
So big. How was the life of a hobo or vagrant post-World War II versus the 20s and 30s? People's view on hobos or vagrants post-World War II were a little different.
Oh, yeah, after World War II. When I was a kid, me and my buddy, if we were going to go to town, which was 5 miles, we'd just walk out on the highway and do this, and the first car come by would pick you up and take you to town. No questions asked. You do that today, or in the last...
Hitchhiking is not a good idea.
In the last 20 or 30 years, and nobody going to stop for you. You'd be walking to wherever you're going.
I think even now, the core of humanity really does want to help others. I think when you see somebody in the street, and I think it's a knee-jerk reaction, it's just who we are naturally. There are jerks in the world, of course.
There's a lot of
people. It's always been that way, but I think... Don't you agree that at a base place...
Right now, I've seen in my time, in the last few decades, that America is going the same way of all great nations. It'll go down the drain sooner or later. There'll be a day when this won't look anything like it does now. Politics.
I think the younger generations should follow your lead. Because the more they see of the world, the more adventures they take, the healthier perspective they'll have.
Yeah, it's so much easier to get around the world now than it was when I was younger.
But I mean, if you leave your box that you're living in, and you see other cultures and experiences, and you have different perspectives.
That's the best education you can get.
Exactly.
I've often thought, I never went to college, but I bet I got more experience in life than any college graduate will ever get out with a degree. I've been around the mountain, my grandma used to say. I've been around the mountain and rode the worst, seen them all.
I've been everywhere, man, I've been everywhere.
I used to love that song. Hank Snow. That was, he made a fortune off of that record. He was that fast, when he get to talking about how them fast places.
Yeah, the hyperspeed, yeah.
Well, you know, that's something else I've watched in my lifetime disappear. I got four radios in my apartment. I can turn anyone on any time of day, and all I get is, it sounds just like Mars. God, I can. I love fixing myself some breakfast this morning about daylight, some coffee. I turned the radio on there by the kitchen table, and I went from one end of that dial to the other, and it sounded just like it was one of them space capsules full of them varmints from some outer space. Then nothing. When I found one guy was singing, it sounded like he had the hiccups, drunk, and was in pain all at the same time.
Now that's a review.
I've watched music disappear. I grew up with music. All the big band era in the 40s. God. And ever since, for 40, 50 years, radio, television, everything just boomed. And now I got them four radios. I can't find no music on any of them. So I have to buy, I got a bunch of records. And when I'm painting, I put a record on, and as soon as I get it's over now. I got to get up and change it. I've been thinking, I need me a jukebox where I can put a dollar in and push about 15 songs.
What do you paint?
For a lot of years, I ran into Native Americans, the Indian people. And I went out and lived with them and painted them in person. And sold a lot of them in Scottsdale, Arizona, and Santa Fe. Santa Fe was one of my best markets. And then the cowboy life, that kind of stuff. Always got horses in, somewhere in the painting. My favorite person to paint was John Wayne. I painted over 200 John Wayne. In fact, I got one on the easel right now.
Wow.
In my studio, there's about 30 John Wayne's. One of his son, Patrick, he had got one of my pictures. Oh. He said I did the best job on his dad. I mean, more made him look more like himself. You know that patch you wore in the last two movies?
Mm-hmm.
That went for $23,000 at auction. It's just a piece of cloth, stiffened cloth. $23,000. You know, he's not an easy man to paint. He's got them little way he looks. And, he's an interesting person. I met him one time on location, and he was just down to earth. No big deal.
Where was that?
Out there in Utah. Me and my Indian buddy, Jesse. We were going out there rambling around. Me and Jesse, we worked on an oil rig. We drilled wells here and there. We worked on a pipeline. We drilled water wells. We was always looking for something to get into. So we come up by making a movie set over there in Utah. And we was going across the Indian Reservation. So we stopped and we got down there. John Wayne had his trailer right down there. And we saw him talking to a guy down there. But they wouldn't let us pass this barrier. Jesse, my buddy, he went in my camper and got that painting of John Wayne that I just finished not long ago. And he was holding it up. And I said, Jesse, God damn it. And John Wayne happened to see it. And he told that guy, I said, tell them to a horse, come on over here. So they let the barrier down there, went over there. And Duke invited us into that trailer. He saw that picture. He said, by God, I like that one. In a magazine article I was reading when it showed John Wayne in his studio, and showed that picture I did of him right behind him.
Nice.
But he thought it was good. He said, that's good. Yeah. I said, okay, I'm going to make you a present of it. And he said, by God, I'll hang that in my house.
And he did.
Yep. But he was down to earth, even no fancy movie star or nothing to him. He was just down to earth. I thought the world of him. I just said, every once in a while I'm going to paint another John Wayne. I'm going to keep painting them till I die.
So what advice would you give to kids today that are complaining or whining, you know, that they can't get a job, their life is boring?
Well, you got to have some incentive. Get out and stir up something on your own. I grew up in the Depression, and that was the thing to do.
You had to stir it up on your own.
Yeah, I mean, you couldn't just sit around. You could. A lot of people did just sit around the homestead and watch everything wilt away. Of course, most people where I grew up had a farm. My grandparents had a big farm. One of my uncles was wealthy. He's a county commissioner. He bought all the land everywhere. You know, when it was dollar acre. Hell, he just bought land here and there. He bought 1,000 acres in British Honduras. He traded 5 acres in North Georgia, timberland. 5 acres for 1,000 acres in British Honduras. And then him and my dad went down there and killed a jaguar. And he got it mounted on his wall.
So when you head off into the sunset, you shouldn't be doing it in a prone position. You should be dancing and hooping and hollering, right?
Get something out of life.
On my Conversation Accessories Facebook page, I've posted a few photos of Vern's paintings, if you're interested in checking them out and maybe buying a couple. Let me know and I'll put you in contact with him. In my continuing celebration of national parks, I'm heading over to the Hubble Trading Post National Historic Site in Ganado, Arizona. The oldest operational trading post on the Navajo Nation, it's been selling groceries, grain, hardware, horse tack, coffee, and Native American art since 1878. The 160 acres is surrounded by the Navajo Nation within the Colorado Plateau geographic region at approximately 6,300 feet in elevation. The trading post was named after J.L. Hubble, who contributed to Arizona statehood and treated the Navajo people respectfully and fairly in selling and trading their handmade items. He purchased the trading post 10 years after Navajos were allowed to return to their homeland after a horrendous exile at Fort Sumner, New Mexico. Hubble is considered the foremost Navajo trader of his time, demanding and promoting excellence in craftsmanship of rug weaving and silversmithing. In the early 1900s, artists visiting the trading post painted illustrations of Navajo rugs, which Hubble displayed on the wall of his rug room. The trading post, which is entirely original, displays a sculpture above the door of a local Navajo man. By the way, two Native American arts and crafts auctions are held here each year, and you can purchase items at the Trading Post Farmers Markets, September and October. Have you discovered some of the Art Everywhere locations? Fun, huh? If you like more art fun, check out Grand Rapids, Michigan's Art Prize, which begins September 24th. Do something different. Write messages on oranges before handing them out.